That's him. That's me. I don't know who that is.
He rides down the street.
I do.
He pedals round the block. Everybody's eager to hear the postman's talk.
What did you say?
La la.
Before the lark or the crowing of the cock. When the morning's dawning, you'll hear the postman's knock.
He's up with the dawn.
Not you know.
Around the clock. Morning, noon, and evening, you'll hear the postman's
to Goon Pod on a very, very hot day. I am joined by an equally sweaty guest, a returning guest. Sorry, Jeremy, didn't mean to refer to you like that.
Thanks Jeremy for getting Phillips. That. Yeah, thanks for getting that out of the way right at the start.
Yeah. Jeremy Phillips from Cinema Limbo.
Hello there.
Thank you for returning. Because last time you were here, it was what? It was 18 months ago, I guess.
It was quite a while, yeah.
And you've come back to talk about a film. But before we go on to that, before we get into that, let's talk about Cinema Limbo, which I have been a guest on two occasions now. I think there was just the one occasion when we last spoke on Goon Pod, but I've subsequently joined you to talk about the comic with Dick Van Dyke.
Yes, a really unusual, fascinating film that's weirdly being forgotten, that Dick Van Dyke's greatest performance, I think, as a really horrible person.
Yeah.
The story of a fictional comic in the 1920s who systemically destroys his own life because of his own ego. And it's a remarkable film from 1969. Available now to watch for free on YouTube because the copyright holder seemingly doesn't care.
That's it's a really good film. I enjoyed talking about it. So Cinema Limbo, I think it's fair to say that you cover both highbrow and lowbrow cinema.
Yes.
The
remit is underappreciated films. So that could equally be films that have been big box office failures, like the most recent version of The Fantastic Four or Hudson Hawk, or more obscure films which have sort of fallen out of the movie conversation, like the comic, or one upcoming film I'm doing. I think the next episode that's coming out is Amsterdammed, which is a Dutch action thriller, which is uniquely Dutch in tone and style, but is easily the equal of anything Hollywood was making in the late 80s.
Okay. Was what's his name? Paul Verhoeven? Was he involved with that at all?
No, it was by the other Dutch director, Dick Maas, and it was his brainchild. Yes, it is a funny name, isn't it?
Sorry, I'm such a child. I tell you, a Dutch film I do enjoy from the 80s. Is it Spoorloos? Is that how it's pronounced? The Vanishing.
I believe so. Yes, George Sliser's The Vanishing. I've not seen the original, but I have seen the American remake he made where they changed the ending, which I won't spoil. It completely blows the film's foot off in terms of quality.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I haven't seen that, but no, the original is very, very good. So in essence, I suppose you examine the sort of films that would be the weird videos on the bottom shelf at the Blockbuster that you'd kind of grudgingly rent when Back to the Future and Rambo and the Terminator were out.
Well, yeah. I mean, the most recent release we've had is Supergirl, which has wound up being bizarrely timely because the Flash has just been released in cinemas, with the first cinema appearance by the character of Supergirl since 1984. And it was interesting to re-examine that film and think about all the reasons why it doesn't work. And
wasn't Peter O'Toole in that?
Peter O'Toole and Peter Cook. Yes, there was an accident and they merged. there's a lot of analogy to the first Superman film, and Peter Cook effectively plays the Ned Beatty role of the villain's funny sidekick. But he's playing it as Peter Cook. So it's very strange to see him in a superhero picture playing henchman to Faye Dunaway as a sorceress who wants to take over the world.
Okay. Any other shows on the slate that you've not yet recorded?
Another one coming up is Equilibrium, the 2002 sci-fi action movie that tries to cross 1984 with The Matrix. And has a bizarre all-star cast for a film that got barely released. Christian Bale, Emily Watson, Sean Bean, and Sean Pertwee. I'm also hoping to do an episode on a film called The Telephone, which was Harry Nilsson's last roll of the dice as a creative force, co-written by him with Terry Southern, directed by Rip Torn, his only film as director.
Blimey.
And jeez, starring Whoopi Goldberg in what is effectively a one-woman show of a woman in her apartment interacting with the outside world through her telephone over the course of 90 minutes in real time. And it was buried at the time. It was, you know, everyone was off their face on cocaine when it was being made. And like I said, it's one of those movies that it's just on YouTube for free and you can watch it for nothing because no one's bothered picking up the rights. And it's a really interesting, strange oddity of all these people either at the end or the beginning of their careers.
Just getting back to Equilibrium, I've got this terrible memory of being at a family event where someone suggested playing charades. You know how they do.
Oh, yes.
And I got given Equilibrium. Can you imagine trying to act that out?
Well, the solution, I think, is rather like in that episode of Peep Show where Jess is given the unbearable lightness of being and he simply mimes Chicken Run instead and dares the person who gave him the piece of paper to correct him.
Okay, so we are talking about a film today, as I said, and it is the 1962 British comedy film Postman's Knock, starring everyone's favourite Spike Milligan. So, Jeremy, why? Because you suggested coming on and talking about this film. Why Postman's Knock? Why this film?
Well, it was on my list of films to cover for Cinema Limbo, so it was a nice sort of overlap in our collective remit. I've been, as I said on the my previous appearance, I've been a huge Goon Show fan for many, many years, ever since I was a young teenager, and I've watched many of the films that Peter Sellers has done. He's my favourite actor. Milligan had a much less eventful career as a film actor, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is his only lead role. Is that right?
Yes. Pretty much, yeah, it is.
So I thought it was interesting that a talent as singular and as visual as his, because Q, I think, works fantastically well in that visual sense. And his writing means that he knows how to tell a story and knows how to explore characters over a long-form piece of work. All of that together yields one single lead role that's fairly obscure. But I found it to be really not as representative of the Spike humor, his style of comedy, as I would have hoped.
Oh, no. I mean, it could have been any. He's a pretty, I mean, in this film, we'll talk about this, he is fairly bland, really. He's not wacky, zany Spike.
There are a couple of moments now and then where he pulls sort of an Eccles-ish face or waggles his eyebrows a bit, but it's immediately lost.
Yeah. So we'll look at the beginnings or how this film came about and Spike's rather abortive film career. So in late 1959, the Running, Jumping and Standing Still film comes out. And in early 1960, it's announced that it's been nominated for an Academy Award. And I know that, I mean, it didn't win it, but it was, you know, a nomination's pretty good. And I know Spike, for the rest of his life, was very proud of that fact. And obviously his colleague, Peter Sellers, was his film career was on the up and up. And in January 1960, The Goon Show ends. And in April 1960, the UK, I think it was the UK arm of MGM, signed Spike up on a contract to make films for at least 7 years, and for a sizable sum. I don't know how much, but he was going to make some decent money out of it. And an MGM spokesman said that Spike is a great personality, and we hope to make full use of his talents as a comic, actor, writer, and ideas man. I think Spike saw himself as equally talented, if not more talented, than Peter Sellers, perhaps. And maybe he saw himself copying some of that success that Sellers was enjoying. Because, you know, with each successive film, you know, the films were getting better and better, more financially successful and critically acclaimed. And Sellers, in fact, won in March 1960, won a Best Actor BAFTA for I'm All Right, Jack. So I wondered whether Spike felt that he himself could make it as a screen actor, a comic screen actor, or an actor, period, because Sellers was turning out to be not just to be, you know, a fine comic on the silver screen, but he was also, he'd also filmed Never Let Go. Have you ever seen Never Let Go, Jeremy?
Yes, I saw that a couple of years ago, and I was very impressed by it.
I thought you were a big boy.
But Alfie won't
I told you never to lift anything within 5 miles around here. Don't you ever learn? Oh, look at that. Right in the veneer. You'd never believe it, would you? Some of these young tarts, they just don't bloody care. Pick it up, Tommy.
Yeah, sure, sir.
You see, they never learn. They all think they know better than I do. But you've only got to look at them and look at me, haven't you? You see, I've got a legitimate business here, Tommy. I've got nearly 200 account customers, and I've got twice as much cash on the side. Why? Because I've learned that money makes money, Tommy boy. Never do anything silly, and you could be all right. Your trouble is you just don't think. You want to think, listen, learn. And don't go doing anything silly again. You see? How about Tommy?
So, you know, he had the dramatic chops as well. And I just wonder whether Spike thought, well, you know, I should be having some of that.
I think maybe he might have been looking towards the likes of Stan Laurel or Jacques Tati in terms of the actor-comedian-writer model of a comedy auteur, and hoping that he was going to have something like that, perhaps.
Possibly, yeah. Although, of course, Postman's Knock, he's credited as contributing some dialogue, but that's about it. But maybe that was the initial motivation. But yeah, his film career didn't take off, and in the early 1970s, in an interview, he said, I'd very much like to have done comedy in films, and I wonder how people who are less funny than I am have got into it. Spike with typical humility. Anyway, Spike in 61 was cast in the film Invasion Quartet alongside Bill Travers, who listeners to Goonpod will have heard us talking about on the Smallest Show on Earth two-parter. And Spike later called the film desperately unfunny. But there was one major positive to come out of it, in as much as he noticed one of the extras in the film, who was a young lady called Patricia Ridgway, who he was subsequently to marry. Around this time that he was filming Invasion Quartet, the BBC were asking for another series of The Goon Show. It appears that the idea for a new series of The Goon Show had been floated sporadically since the end of Series 10 in January 1960. And Harry was usually willing, but the other two, particularly Spike, kind of blew hot or cold on the idea. So when he was approached in summer 1961, he wrote to the BBC and he said, "As much as I would like to write the show, I'm sorry, but I cannot throw money away by taking money at a smaller remuneration. Therefore, my decision is that I want to write the show, but cannot afford to write under the conditions the BBC stipulate." So basically, he was saying that he didn't want to turn down MGM film work or compromise his commitment to MGM. Well, that was where the real money was. But really, after Invasion Quartet, there was Postman's Knock, and that was it.
I mean, he had a significant number of other film roles during the rest of his career.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
oh yes.
Only a little while ago, I was listening to the Last Word obituary on Raquel Welch, and aren't they a couple in the Three and the Four Musketeers?
Yeah, Three Musketeers. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And his cameo in Life of Brian. I think was Yellowbeard his last film?
Do you know? I think it may have been. Yeah, that was 83, wasn't it?
Yes,
I think it may well have been. Yeah, absolutely. He was in a string of films, but never. It was usually a cameo role, or at least third or fourth or fifth down the cast list.
It was a special guest star.
Yeah,
Spike Milligan,
as in Digby, the biggest dog in the world.
Oh well, I mean, the big star there is the dog.
Yes, saying that, we said was Postman's Knock his only starring role. I suppose you could also say The Great McGonagall. In the mid 70s, although he is the star of that. He's the titular star, isn't he?
I've not seen it. My understanding was it was kind of a split lead with Sellers.
Well, I guess that was just to make sure that he could get Sellers on board, but Sellers is only in it for probably about 7 or 8 minutes in total.
So Ghost and the Noonday Sun would be more of a split between the two.
Well, that was more Sellers, yeah. Milligan's right. It turns up quite late in that film. So I would say The Great McGonagall was probably his last big film role, for sure. But he was turning up in things like, you know, Hound of the Baskervilles, The Cook and Moore, Hound of the Baskervilles. Last remake of Beau Geste, Marty Feldman. Seen any of those?
No, I haven't actually. It always seems to be in support of other great comedians. So you've got Marty Feldman, Cook and Moore. Yep. He was in History of the World Part One for Mel Brooks, I think.
Yes, he was.
And then Yellowbeard for Graham Chapman. Mm-hmm. So it's always sort of, it's nice to think that it's the next generation of comedians wanting to bring in Spike, someone who they love and respect. But
true.
But it could just be that he was offered well-paid acting work and said, "Oh, all right then."
Yeah, well, I know Life of Brian, famously, he was just on holiday in Tunisia.
Oh, yeah, that was just pure chance that he was there.
Yeah. So February 1962, he's a very busy man. Early February, the bed-sitting room play began. There's an audio recording of Spike live at the Belgrade Theatre, Coventry, recorded 18th of February 1962, where there was jazz and comedy. And Postman's Knock, the film we're talking about today, was released on the 22nd of February, 1962. The film is, what would you call it, a gentle comedy, typical of the sort of comedies, low-budget British comedies that were coming out this time.
It feels very Ealing. It feels very Norman Wisdom of the little man against the system. I can imagine they would have lapped this up in Albania.
well, absolutely. Because I was thinking watching it, it's yet there's a notable scene or scenes where you've got another example of the triumph of the little man over newfangled technology. Everything's mechanized and modern, isn't and I guess it's playing to that audience, which is largely consisting of people suspicious of the march of progress and the increased automation of the workplace.
It's always very pro-worker, pro-union often.
Yeah.
And it's interesting then to look at the Carry On films, which were consistently successful. But then in 1970, you have Carry On at Your Convenience, which is a satire on labor relations and mm-hmm. union politics. And it was famously a bomb because it ran counter to what the audience wanted.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's my favorite Carry On film. That and it sort of it alternates between that and Carry On Abroad. What's your favorite? No, don't say Columbus.
No, I've done an episode on Carry On Columbus
with me.
Oh well, yes. Mm. And didn't we do well?
Didn't we not?
No, I would. I have very fond memories of Carry On Doctor and Carry On Up the Jungle, but I think I'd have to go for Up the Khyber.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just the most lavishly produced, most polished, most witty film in the series, and where with everyone at the height of their abilities, with this all these resources behind them, location filming in far off Wales.
Yeah, it's a good. I mean, all I think whenever I think of Carry On, Up the Khyber, I just think of Tiffin.
I just think of Kenneth Williams' face and his nostrils opening up like Channel Tunnel.
It's not flared nostrils, yeah. Okay, so Postman's Knock. So starring Spike as Harold Petz, who is a rural village postman who somehow or other gets a job in the big city. And chaos ensues. Now, the first observation I would make, Spike, as I say, plays Harold Petz, and I think his surname was presumably coined purely and simply in order to trade on a recurring gag. I didn't think they allowed Petz in the post office, which we heard a couple of times. I think that's the only reason he's called Harold Petz.
The name's Petz. Harold Petz. I didn't think we'd live to see the day when Petz were allowed in the post office. Hey, Mr. Burns?
Very funny, sir.
Yes, I mean, the name needs to be something small and concise. It doesn't. It shouldn't be too over elaborate because that makes him sound too big. It needs to be little because he's a little man. In the system, so it fits very neatly, but it also feels a bit too formulaic, as much of the film does, I think.
So the original story is by Jack Trevor Story, who I knew from, he wrote The Trouble with Harry, which is a very underrated Hitchcock film.
Yes, it's very, very good.
He also wrote Invasion Quartet, which was the film Spike made before this. And the screenplay was by Jack Trevor Story and John Briley, with additional dialogue, as I said, by Spike and George Barclay. And it was directed by someone I hadn't, until this week, and I was obviously doing research for our conversation, directed by Robert Lynn, who I'd never heard of. Who didn't really do much else. I mean, he did quite a bit of tally in the 60s and 70s, and he produced The Railway Children, but his career never really amounted to much. Having said all that, last night I was watching, for my sins, the fiendish plot of Dr. Fu Manchu.
Oh.
Yeah, because that is an upcoming episode we're doing on Goonpod, and I was watching it with someone, a mutual friend, Tilt, Gary, and Andrew as well, and I noticed that Robert Lynn was listed as location manager, and I think that he died about a year later, so that was Fu Manchu was one of his last films, although obviously he wasn't directing it. So we've got Spike, we've got, as well on the cast, Barbara Shelley as Jean, who's essentially the love interest for Harold.
What did you say her name was?
It's Barbara Shelley.
Yeah, the character.
Jean.
Where is it you got that from? Because I don't think her name is said at any point in the film.
It's not, but it, on Wikipedia and on IMDb, it's down as Gene. But yeah, because that's the thing. Right up until the last 15 minutes, they're addressing each other. She calls him postman, and he calls her miss. And then she permits him, or he permits her, to call him Harold. But she doesn't reciprocate, I don't think. And they eventually get married, and I'm not even sure he knows what her name is.
No, I mean, again, there's humour in that of, oh, he never finds out her name, and maybe it turns out she doesn't have a name, and like the marriage certificate just has a blank space. it's sloppy, really. And given that there's a scene where she's introduced to, we see her friend.
Oh, Barbara, played by the wonderful Denise Coffey.
Oh, she gets a name.
Oh yeah, she gets a name in it. Yeah, but you'd have thought, yes, exactly. You'd thought she'd have walked in the flat and say, "Hello, Jean," or something like that.
Oh, Jean, I've been painting all night.
Yeah. And that twat of a critic, art critic, who will come to. Mind you, he wouldn't have referred to her as Jean, would he? He'd have said, "Oh dear, Miss Cooper," or whatever her surname was. You know, he'd have been condescending like that.
I can't imagine I'll ever live to see the name of Miss Jean Cooper in the National Gallery.
Yes.
and then, of course, he should, and it should be a painting of Harold.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Now, I don't know much about Barbara Shelley, really, shamefully. What do you, I mean, obviously she's a very popular actress, Village of the Damned, Dracula, Prince of Darkness and the like, but do you know her from any particular films or television?
Well, she was a huge name in horror films rather than for a comedy. Hmm. And had, as you say, did a bunch of films with Hammer during the 60s, The Gorgon, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Quatermass and The Pit. Postman's Knock is a weird sort of aberration in her career, because she'd done several major movies already. She was in Village of the Damned, but now she's in this very light comedy in quite a thankless role, and it seems like a very backward step. Maybe she was under contract. Maybe she wanted to work with Spike.
Possibly.
Maybe Spike wanted to work with her.
Yeah, but she doesn't have a lot to do, really, does she?
No. There is some character development for her during the course of the story. But there's... I mean, the fact that she's never given a name is pretty indicative of how sloppily she's treated. In my notes, I've just referred to her as artist.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what else to call her.
Yeah, well, she's an art student. And Harold first sees her at the train station as he arrives into London. She's painting. She's on the platform painting, isn't she? But the film begins, so we see this chat. We'll talk through the rest of the cast as we come to them. We see this little, charming little rural village that we come to know as Upper Fringley. And you have the early morning train with the mail on it, and it blows its whistle in a presumably prearranged fashion. And it rouses postman Harold Petts from his slumbers. And he leaps out of bed, runs to the window, and blows a bugle in response. And then he gets dressed in this very kind of... The way he gets dressed made me think, I wonder if Nick Park ever saw this film. Because it made me think it's something out of Wallace and Gromit. He's got this...
He's got the two hooks that he hooks his nightshirt, the sleeves of his nightshirt onto, and pulls himself out of it, and in a single motion pulls his trousers out from under the mattress and puts them on.
Yes, that's it.
Where they've been pressing overnight.
And then he pelts down the stairs. His mum's waiting with a sandwich for his breakfast or a piece of toast. And he's on his bike, and he takes delivery from the train, the moving train, of a large sack of mail. And then he proceeds to make his morning deliveries. And it's clear that the villagers are very, very fond of Harold. He arrives home and he delivers himself a letter from a Mr. Fordyce, and he's been offered a job down in that London. I couldn't quite tell, but it looks like that it's pretty much he has to leave for London that very same day. Did you get that impression?
Yes, I mean, there could have been a single couple of words of dialogue to say, oh, I have to go there next week.
Yeah.
But no, it does look like he's going that day with no postal service tomorrow, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. Who's going to replace him? And it looks like the whole village has turned out to see him off at the station, including a very tardy Mario Fabrizi, who doesn't have time to read the speech that he prepared. And it's always a good film. You always know that you're watching a good black and white British comedy film when you see the very familiar moustaches of Mario Fabrizi, who sadly died soon after this film came out, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. So Harold arrives in London, and as I say, he sees, as you call it, artist on the platform painting. And Harold obviously is lacking the social graces, and he's ignorant of how one should conduct oneself in the nation's capital. In other words, never make eye contact with anybody. I was writing in my notes all the way through watching this film. Everyone is bloody rude in London, as far as this film's concerned, anyway.
Well, it's a reflection on, I think, what the audience wants to see. Everyone in the countryside is all nice and lovely, and they'll come in and have a cup of tea and a slice of cake. And everyone in the city wants to mug you and steal your trousers and is mean and horrible all the time.
And then we have some business on the platform, which kind of showcases Harold as being a very efficient and fast-working postman. Got mail being loaded onto a train and unloaded. I wasn't quite sure. But there's some malarkey with some mail being driven off by Arthur Mullard, who's always is he always a welcome face in British films? I'm not quite sure if he is.
Well, given what we now know about his personal life, possibly not.
Yeah.
But he's a good choice for that character. The one round type meathead.
Yeah.
And he does get one really great line of dialogue later, which I think is worth noting.
Yeah, he's always Arthur Mullard. He's not an actor with tremendous range, but he is trying to make off with some mail on a trolley. There's a chase.
Here, I say! I say you! What are you doing with our mail?
It's not your mail, sir. It's his mail. He dropped it.
That's not a post bag. Where's the mail we just unloaded?
What's the trouble here?
Mail robbery. We caught this one red-handed.
No. You got it all wrong. I'm one of them. I'm a postman. I've just been transferred here. Here, look, I got a letter. There she is.
Is this what all the trouble's about?
Where'd you get that post bag? What? She's one of them.
One of what? I'm an art student.
I wouldn't be surprised.
That's my grandfather's bag. He was in the post office, you know. And my father.
All right,
and
come
his
along,
great-grandfather,
both of you. You can tell it to the inspector.
And his great-great-great-grandfather.
But there's some confusion because Harold's all involved in this unwittingly. And so a constable summoned. And it's John Wood. John Wood CBE. A very fine actor. Do you recognise him from anything?
Yes. Wasn't he in For Your Eyes Only as Dennis Thatcher?
Oh, was that not Wells? John Wells?
Yes, I'm always getting the two confused.
Yes. Well, there's John Bird, John Wells, and John Fortune. I always get those three confused. Well, John Wood, I looked at his IMDb page. It's massive. I mean, he was a huge theatre actor. And funny enough, interestingly, for this podcast, he was Peter Sellers' understudy in Brouhaha in 1958-59. He did a lot of early TV, a lot of TV. He was Barnaby Rudge in a early 60s TV adaptation. He was also in Invasion Quartet with Spike just before this. And he made loads of films, including, believe it or not, Jumping Jack Flash in the 80s.
I'm just looking at his later filmography. I mean, Jumping Jack Flash ties in nicely because that was another Whoopi Goldberg vehicle, like The Telephone. And one of his last film roles was the film of The Avengers, which was the very first recorded edition of my podcast.
Is that the one based on
Ralph Fiennes, John Steed and Mrs. Peel one.
Right. Yeah.
In which he plays a tailor.
Right. Okay. Yeah. See, I don't recognize him from anything, but look at his IMDb, massive. But it's not one of those faces that I instantly recognize. He's very tall, quite lanky, isn't he?
Yes.
His name is John. The actor is John Wood. John Wood. But he's playing PC Woods. And later on, we've got Wilfred Lawson playing a postman called Postman Lawson. So there's not a lot of thought went into the names, and they didn't even give Barbara Shelley one. God's sake.
Actually, there's one other that's worth noting is that Wood was in the film War Games in 1983, the nuclear war thriller.
Yeah.
And his character was originally to have been played by John Lennon.
What?
The designer of the supercomputer, who then retires because he wants peace, that character was to have been played by John Lennon, but he was killed when the script was being developed. And when it was eventually released, that character was played by John Wood.
That's incredible. Okay. So we see Mallard turn up at some rendezvous, meets up with the rest of the gang that he's in, and the gang is typically hopeless and hapless, as is the rule in black and white British comedies around this time.
They feel like they've escaped from a Children's Film Foundation production.
Yes, they do. They do. Yeah, they embody ineptitude, stupidity, clumsiness, and you've got Warren Mitchell.
The four humours.
You've got Warren Mitchell as Rupert, which I thought was quite an odd name for a robber. Lance Percival didn't get his name, and John Bennett. And John Bennett, you talk about IMDb entries. My God, he's been in everything, and I think he's probably best known there. I mean, he was in like A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, House of Drip Blood, 11 Doctor Who's, I believe. Give My Regards to Broad Street, getting back to the Beatles connection. Mulberry, don't know if you remember Mulberry, that sitcom.
I do, yes. Norman.
Yeah. He was in The Pianist with your man. What's his name?
Adrian Brody.
Yeah. And Minority Report. But I noticed that he was listed as the medical officer in Porridge, and I'm thinking it's probably that famous scene with the feet.
Yes. Yes, that's him.
Suffer from any illness? Bad feet. Suffer from any illness? Bad feet. Made a recent visit to a doctor or hospital?
Only when me bad feet.
Are you now, or have you at any time been a practicing homosexual?
What were these feet?
Yeah, so we've got these four who make up the comedy gang.
I ought to correct you. Sorry. The Doctor Who fan pedant in me has come out. You said he was in 11 Doctor Who's. He was in 11 episodes of two different serials.
All right.
Which
doctors?
He played a corrupt general as part of a conspiracy with John Pertwee. And then opposite Tom Baker, he played a Chinese stage magician in full yellow face makeup, which remains very controversial. But his performance is a bit more thoughtful and complex than you might have expected, but it's still not great.
And of course, as I said before, in a few weeks' time, we'll be discussing the fiendish plot of Dr. Fu Manchu.
Well, if you can think of a way that that film is in any way acceptable... I will send you a book token.
Well, you'll have to listen to the episode then. At the police station, meanwhile, the inspector refuses to believe that Harold is a postman, or for that matter, that the artist is an art student. And Harold insists that his father and his grandfather were postmen. And we actually earlier saw some mocked up pictures on Harold's mum's front parlour wall of Spike made up to be Pets senior and Pets even more senior as post people. And Mr. Fordyce arrives from the post office. Right. Now, have you ever met or heard of anyone called Fordyce outside of British comedy pre-1980?
Oh, no.
No.
It's like Grimsdale.
Yeah.
No one's actually called that.
No. So Mr. Fordyce is played by Ronald Adam. Just you see him and you just think, oh, that guy. Been in so many things. But his, as you know, obviously he was a character actor, but he supposedly was shot down by the Red Baron in World War One. Did you know that?
I did not. That's quite a claim to fame.
Hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's lots of film. He's been in lots of films with goons. He was in Heavens Above, Carlton Brown of the FO, Naked Truth, Helter Skelter, that had early role for Harry Secombe in that, and Song of Norway with Harry. And he was in Carry On Admiral, which is famous for what reason?
It's not a Carry On film.
Exactly. What was that? Was that 2 or 3 years before Sergeant?
I think so. Yeah, about then, I think.
So he arrives at the police station, vouches for Harold, and the inspector grudgingly releases Harold and Jean. And there's reference made to the Molden Gang. And I immediately assumed that the Molden Gang was Warren Mitchell and his mates, but turns out not to be. Harold's out on the street and he has to find some digs. And he asks Jean if she can help, and she directs him to the nearest tube station. And then after taking the best part of an afternoon to cross the road, a busy road.
That's what it's like in the big town, you know.
Yeah. And he eventually manages to cross the road and find the tube station.
Well, he gets hit by a mini first, and that comes back as a gag later of him being hit by another mini.
Yeah.
And we just hear it off screen, and then we cut back and he's sprawled across the bonnet and roof.
Yeah, and he hits upon the idea of using a blind man as a kind of shield buffer.
I got the impression that the blind man just grabbed him and then launched both of them across the street. Presumably on the logic that if you can't see the traffic, then it can't see you. Or the other way around.
Yeah. The chief inspector back at the police station, he isn't buying this innocent postman story. So he assigns PC Woods to, what would you call it, detective detail? He tells him to follow Harold and report back regularly. Surveillance, yes, surveillance. And then we see Spike. We have quite a bit of business on the tube, at the tube station, with people being crammed in like sardines, and a brief scene where Harold's convinced that one of his fellow passengers has done a wee on his trouser leg.
And it's a vicar as well.
Of course it is. Yeah.
And he also, at one point, rises up through the beard of an Orthodox priest.
It's funnier you say that than the actual scene.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Saying it aloud, it sounds very goonish, I think. But if you see it, you think, well, okay.
Mm. And Harold is just getting sort of shuffled, pushed, pulled, and ends up going full circle, ends up back at the tube station that he began. I noticed at one point we see a poster on a platform wall for the Magnificent Seven playing at the London Pavilion, because filming for this film began in May 1961, which was a month after that film was released in the UK.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's always a good idea to remind the audience of other better films.
And Warren Mitchell's gang read about the business at the train station in the newspaper. And in the newspaper story, there's speculation that the botched robbery may have been the work of the Molden Gang. And Rupert thinks that Harold must be involved with the Malden gang, and so tells Arthur Mullard to follow him. So we have, obviously, PC Woods and now Arthur Mullard trailing Harold around London.
Miss! Hello, it's me, the postman.
I know.
Am I glad I found you? You sure there's a station called Wimblesham Row?
You mean you haven't found it yet?
No, I've been on the Underground Tube Railway ever since I last saw you.
Look, postman, try and make your way through life without me, Good night.
But, miss, I haven't got anywhere to sleep tonight.
Come on. Well, come on. I'm going to regret this.
My word, I'm certainly glad I met you.
Jean walks past and reluctantly agrees to let him doss down at her flat for the night. And then PC Woods puts two and two together because he's followed them, and he phones his inspector and says the postman and the girl live at the same address. And the inspector's delighted by this because it supports his wholly flimsy theory that there's some sort of villainy afoot. And then PC Woods spends the whole night sort of sat outside the flat near the bins.
Well, there's on their way, there's a sequence I rather like where they walk past the Jean and Harold walk past the front door of one of the other people who live in the building where the bread and the milk are piling up, and Harold asks about whoever might be in there, but Jean doesn't know them, and he's astonished that you wouldn't know who your neighbors are, and you turn a blind eye when they might be in trouble.
Well, yeah, because he's come from such a close-knit little community. It's completely alien to him that you wouldn't know everybody that lives within a mile of your vicinity.
Yeah, within screaming distance.
Yeah. Okay, so the next morning, he arrives at the postal depot, the post office, bright and early. How did he find it, bearing in mind he couldn't find his arse in his underpants, let alone ride the tube? How did he manage so quickly and efficiently to find the post office? But anyway, we'll let that slide.
He's a postman. He has postal senses.
Yes, he can.
He can smell the sellotape.
Smell the sellotape, the stamps. He reports for duty, and we get some physical comedy with a conveyor belt.
I like that when he's sleeping on the conveyor belt, he's using a parcel as a pillow.
But everyone is rude and nobody notices anything. That's something else I wrote down throughout this film.
Well, it's the kind of the robotic machine element, that the people are just machine parts within this system, and they're not looking at things individually as kind, caring countryside postal workers would.
There is that. And Harold goes out on his first round with Wilfred Lawson, and he's assigned an incredibly modern looking block of flats for the time, and I imagine that those flats probably aged very badly over the following decade.
Yeah, they look like they're patient zero of sick building syndrome.
And we have this comedy sequence with automatic doors, which maybe were a novelty for 1961. I don't know.
I think so. It's a shame because the whole scene of Harold fiddling around with the infrared eye, there's potential there for, I think, some interesting goonish type humour, but it's really just thrown away with dull antics and arm waving, really.
Yeah, I've never really watched Norman Wisdom films. Would Norman Wisdom have done it better? I'm sure he probably would have done.
I think he would have taken it to it more naturally, because that kind of more lightweight material, I think, is more his key. Milligan, it just doesn't fit with the type of comedy he's used to and that he's has such expertise for. It seems too much like a waste of ability and a waste of talent to have a great mind like his doing these, I don't want to say lowbrow, lower quality material.
Yeah, this does seem, like you say, a waste of his talent. And we have a showdown with a typically large, matronly looking cleaning lady, char lady. Why is it in these films of this period that ladies of that type, shall we say, of that build, are always portrayed as scowling harridans who want to do real damage to our hapless hero or heroes? Why is that?
Mothers-in-law,
yes.
Well, I mean, we could go into it psychologically, and it's, you know, male fear of female power.
It's not that kind of podcast. And we see the most powerful vacuum cleaner in Christendom trying to suck up Harold's letters and almost amputate his hand at one point. And there's a bit where he's walking along a corridor posting letters through letter slots. And one door has the slot on its side, and we get a comedy Chinese musical sting. Why is that? I didn't get that.
I think it's the idea, like, because rather than being horizontal, like our normal Western letter slots, it's like an, I think it in terms of eyes, maybe.
Okay.
I mean, it's, I don't know.
Maybe the 1962 cinema audience were rolling in the aisles at that. Lawson's waiting outside impatiently for Harold to finish his round. But Harold tries to go back into the building, but an engineer is fixing the automatic door. And Harold brains himself on the glass, and he falls backwards all of a heap on the ground. And the engineer sort of just glances at him and doesn't care. Because, as I say, nobody notices anything and nobody gives a toss.
That engineer's grandson now works in IT and has exactly the same attitude.
We see a dog at one point. A dog runs off with some letters. Jack Trevor story, mindful of the old comedy writer's maxim that audiences love a cheeky dog, of course. And later we hear that there's been some complaints to the post office that a dog was delivering letters, which I thought was quite sweet.
I wouldn't have complained about that. I would have found it a charming novelty.
Yeah, but people complain about anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, in the big city. I mean, this tree's the wrong colour. I mean, it's typical.
Mm. This has been going on for, what, I don't know, 45 minutes, something like that. Bit of character development, but not much. And then we get some plot.
Here! Listen.
Watch it.
Not a trace of the Morden gang, nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. But I'm sitting in a coffee bar having a cup of tea and, you know, wondering how to pay for it. When I hear on the radio, the Bank of England are calling in 2 million old pound notes for burning. And the post office and the railways are handling this stuff. The post office. The post office.
The post... 2 million going through the... So that's what the Morden gang was after.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're going to get there first. We're going to do it proper this time. With finesse.
Harold bumps into Arthur Mullard in the street. And says, oh, I know you, don't I? And he replies, no, that was someone else. I'm French. Au revoir.
Yes.
And that was the bit that I thought was that funny. That was the one I wrote down.
And didn't he say Auf Wiedersehen later on as well?
Yeah, he does. Again, yeah. Again, no accent. But art student comes home and reaches for her neighbour's milk and bread, as though Harold's influence of small village goodness is rubbing off on her.
Yeah, she reaches for it, and then she changes her mind, doesn't she?
Yeah, she doesn't want to break the code of ignoring everyone around you.
Being a pig ignorant Londoner, yeah.
I lived in London for 20 years. I'm quite pleased to leave that sort of environment behind.
Harold sleeps through his alarm and is 5 hours late for work. And Rupert's gang are on a tour of the post office. And this is where we have the mechanized letter sorter, which apparently cost £150,000. Now, I didn't check the inflation calculator, but I imagine £150,000 in 1961 is probably about £18 million now.
Allow me to check. £2.6 million, I think.
Oh, is that all? Oh, right. Okay. I think so. Well, that's entirely plausible then. But Harold is racing the mechanized letter sorter and manages to beat it, and it short circuits. And the
watching tourists all applaud.
Yeah. But of course, the philosophy of the post office is the elimination of the human element in favor of mechanized industry. And by destroying the mechanized sorter, Harold has struck a blow against that philosophy. Or at least that's what the chairman of the post office, Bob Todd, tells Harold. And then suggests that Harold should see a psychiatrist. And by the way, Bob Todd, looking very suave.
Oh, yes.
Unusually so.
I mean, Robert Todd, almost.
Hmm. The art student, Jean, there's an art school exhibition, and an art critic who thinks he's the absolute shiz is examining her paintings, and he's being a totally patronising arse. And I wrote down what he said. He said, "My dear young lady, I can't help myself, I must be frank. Take to matrimony, motherhood, something which requires neither mental effort or imagination. Take a job, sell some stockings, stick to the simple things in life." Despite this, he somehow manages to avoid a swift knee to the spuds.
I was really shocked when I watched that for the first time at how cruel he is.
Yeah.
I mean, he was lucky to leave that room alive.
But she didn't even seem bothered by that. She was upset because he didn't like a painting. She wasn't upset by the misogyny, by the chauvinism.
It was appalling.
Yeah. The chairman, Bob Todd, has suggested that Harold see a psychiatrist. I don't quite know why.
Maybe they're hoping that they can get Harold invalided out of the postal service. Mm. Because if he's better than the machines, then he's too much of an embarrassment. But they do say at one point that they can't fire him because he's a civil servant.
Yes. And the psychiatrist is Miles Mallison, who was the George Clooney of 1950s British cinema, I think it's fair to say. He lost his looks somewhat by the 60s, but he's still, still a very striking looking man. And he hides in the closet to observe Harold, who comes into his office and lickety-split solves all these puzzle tests that are on the tables. What the film is trying to tell us is that Harold is some sort of... What's the phrase, Jeremy? Is it idiot savant?
I think that's the one you mean. But the way the film portrays him is he's just a simple country lad who's very good at puzzles, and he's better than the city types at everything, and that is shown by him being a genius, because the script doesn't really know how else to have him best them, I think.
Well, yeah, but he then, for some reason, the psychiatrist, I don't know why the psychiatrist is setting him this district superintendent test, because Harold passes with the highest results ever recorded.
And he knows all these answers off the top of his head, like the postage rates to Afghanistan and...
Yes, which they wouldn't have had to, in Upper Fringley, they wouldn't have to send parcel post to Kabul, you'd have thought.
Well, I'd like to ask you a few more questions. Oh, where are they? The questions seem rather more elusive than the answers. Oh, I'm so sorry.
So am I.
Here they are. We'll attend to that later. Postman, ordinary grade. What is the parcel rate to Afghanistan?
First class mile, sixpence an ounce. Second class mile, threepence an ounce. Air miles, shilling an ounce. All other miles, ninepence an ounce.
Yeah, yes, that's quite correct. Well, let's try this. Yes, upper grade postman. A postbag containing 35 parcels weighs 54 pounds. If 2/3 of the parcels weigh twice as much as 3/8 of the parcels, How much will 10 of the parcels weigh?
£18.
Goodness gracious me. £18. That's right. That's quite correct.
Yeah. And as you say, Bob Todd and his minions debate what to do about Harold. They can't fire him because he's a civil servant, so they decide to put him where he can cause no trouble. So he's assigned to the parcel sorting section, which, if you ask me, there is trouble inherent in the idea of a parcel sorting section, big bulky packages and the like. But again, he's very, very fast, very swift.
He basically he does all the sorting himself while the other sorters just sort of stand and watch.
Yeah, open-mouthed. And Jean decides she needs a job because she can't cut it as an artist. She can't make it as an artist. And Harold says he'll get her a job at the post office. And he's only been there, what, 2 days? He thinks he's got that influence. But anyway, Woods, who's listening outside the door, dressed as a gas man and an electricity meter reader, he hears them talking, but he only hears certain phrases, such as big job at the post office. And he misconstrues that to mean a robbery at the post office, and he calls it in. But we have this little bit of the little, slightly sweet little moment between the art student and the postman. And as we said earlier, he tells her his name, but keeps calling her Miss. And then we're really into the last leg of the film with the police escort transporting. Police escort following this van transporting £2 million of notes to the post office.
We have had a goon type verbal joke when Woods phones in his report and he's told, you'll get promotion to constable for this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. I'm already a constable.
And Rupert and his gang have looked like they've consolidated or teamed up with another gang, including a gentleman who talks quite posh, and they're going to pool resources and they're going to knock out postmen all over London so they can pose as them at the post office and try and filch this £2 million. And of course, as is the way of these films, there's a police detail disguised as postmen also dispatched to the post office. And I guess rather than spoil a quarter of an hour of slapstick gold, which there's a chase and people being knocked out.
There's an awful lot of antics.
Antics, that's the word. Yes. But everything is tied up with a neat little bow. The superintendent, the inspector, is happy because somehow or other the Molden gang have been quite unaccountably seized in Brighton. And somehow he gets the credit for that. I don't know why. But PC Woods is still convinced that Harold's in on something. And Harold saved the day, and there must have been a passage of time because we next see Harold and Jean living back in Upper Fringley. And I guess he's now postmaster or something, and she's designing cards. And Woods is there still spying on them. And the film ends with him getting a horn up his ass from a bull.
Yes, it's a very disappointing film, I think. There's so much potential with the central idea. I mean, I mentioned Jacques Tati earlier. Have you seen any of his work?
Monsieur Hulot's Holiday?
Possibly his best film, but his first feature was Jour de Fête, Festival Day, in which he plays the postman in a little country village who sees a film about the American Postal Service, which is this incredibly over-exaggerated paramilitary operation with parachutists and beach landings and everything. And he decides to try and emulate that and go for increased efficiency and completing his round at breakneck pace. And it's full of visual gags and verbal humor. And it seemed like a really clear inspiration for this, but that only works if you have a mind as gifted as Tati's or Milligan's driving the whole production. Instead, you have Milligan really being just an actor.
Yes.
And so rather than Jacques Tati, it feels too much like later Laurel and Hardy, where they were just hired as actors and Stan Laurel had no creative input into the scripts at all. And those films are gruesome to watch.
Mm.
This isn't quite that bad.
What's Atoll K? Is that one of them?
I've never been able to bring myself to watch Atoll K.
I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
They made half a dozen films with 20th Century Fox during the 40s after they left Hal Roach. And those films are pretty bad. Atoll K apparently is just too depressing.
Yeah.
Of seeing these two very ill old men going through the motions in this terrible, poorly written script.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Milligan is much more of a clown. He can do these very big, like the big eyes and the miming and the visual slapstick. He can make something out of that, I think, but he doesn't have the control or the authority over this as a project to lean into that. He's just being pigeonholed as the light comic lead. I mean, I'm amazed that he doesn't get to do a song.
Well, he does kind of, because the best thing about this film is the theme tune, I think, at the beginning and the
end. Oh, yes, of course.
Which I absolutely love, and it was released as a single. I've listened to it often over the years, and I think it's a charming little piece. But I think with the film itself, I think Spike probably found, while he was making it, he probably thought it was a load of rubbish. I would imagine he would have, but he was thinking, well, if it gets me fame and fortune, and you know, further step up the rung of success, then so be it. But if his heart isn't really in it, because you know he's not really involved with the writing or direction or anything like that, then maybe that's why. Maybe if he'd been more involved, as in the Goon shows, although they're audio, obviously, you know, he gives a much more powerful performance in the Goon shows than he does in this.
If he'd been given sort of the story outline or an early draft of the script and asked to just tailor it for his own style of comedy, I think it would have worked a lot better. It would have had the spine of a traditional Ealing type comedy, but it could have been filled with the more Milligan humor that would be fresher and more original and really mark it out as something quite different. Instead, it's just another piece on the production line.
Yeah. I just want to say, mention the theme tune. Now, Herbert Kretzmer actually wrote the lyrics for the Postman's Knock.
Oh, yes.
Theme tune. Have you heard of Herbert Kretzmer?
The name rings a bell. I'm sure you can enlighten me.
Okay, so he was a good friend, actually, of Peter Sellers, but also Spike. And he interviewed Spike a couple of weeks for the Daily Express, a couple of weeks after Postman's Knock was released. I think the film more or less sank without trace. It didn't really do any business. But he interviewed Spike for the newspaper, and I just want to share some extracts, if you don't mind, because it's quite revealing. He, meaning Milligan, he is against everything and everybody. He announces, "I hate the human race. I am unemployed," says Mr. Milligan. "Nobody wants me. The television doesn't want me. The BBC doesn't want me. I have become little more than a nuisance to the cowards and idiots who run the BBC. To hell with them." So Herbert Kretzmer clearly caught Spike on one of his good days. He carries on. "Mr. Milligan is widely recognised and venerated as a comic genius, but he insists, I am basically the unfunniest person in the world. But such conscious martyrdom has no real basis in fact. In any other terms than his own, Spike Milligan is a success. Last year, he starred in two MGM films, Invasion Quartet and Postman's Knock. He bought out a long-playing record called Milligan Preserved and a book, A Dustbin of Milligan, which became one of the country's bestsellers. His tenure as radio compere of Children's Choice was a runaway triumph. Milligan appeared in the Mermaid Theatre production of Treasure Island. He also found time to write a novel and a play. Yet Milligan insists on seeing 1961 as a disastrous year which saw him tottering on the edge of bankruptcy. He says, I don't work anymore. I'm living on the cash I've saved. So I just thought that was very revealing because, you know, he's, as Kretzmer sets out there, he's been incredibly busy and successful. Not always, not with the films maybe, but he's been busy and he's been making money. But he still sees himself as a failure who's more or less penniless.
I think a lot of that might well be the disorder talking.
Oh, I know. I absolutely know. But yeah, if he'd gone the next day and interviewed him, it might have been something completely different, completely different Milligan.
I thought I knew that Kretzmer's name rang a bell, and I've looked it up. He was the lyricist for the English language version of Les Miserables.
Oh, blimey. Okay. Well, because if you read the Roger Lewis book about Sellers, he crops up quite a lot, Kretzmer. And I remember there's a story in there. Let me just try and... I might edit this bit out. There's a story in the Roger Lewis book about Kretzmer's been invited to Peter Sellers's London flat one evening. For what Sellers promises to be like a really magnificent, properly authentic Indian dinner party. Okay. And right. He invites Spike as well. So Spike's there as well. And I don't know, I'm guessing this must be sort of mid 60s, something like that. So Kretzmer arrives, Spike's there. Peter's really distant and distracted. Okay. As is his way. But they're sort of they sit around this big table and they're waiting for the there's no cutlery, there's no wine, there's nothing on the table, just like a glass table, I think. And then there's a knock on the door and a takeaway driver delivers a mass of curries in foil trays, as you would get today.
Yeah.
And Sellers basically had them spread out on this large table and got some plastic forks, and the guests just had to eat out of the trays with forks. So no wine or anything like that. And Sellers wasn't even sat at the table. He was over at the record player, sticking on and then taking off LPs and then staring through a telescope, which he's got directed at Big Ben, I think. Okay. And completely ignoring his guests. So it's a real sort of bit of a disaster as far as dinner parties go. But the next day, Kretzmer, I guess, felt obliged to telephone Sellers and thank him for the night before. And since Sellers says something like, yes, it's nice. You have to make an effort sometimes to entertain one's friends and give them good food and conversation, which is just...
Yes, I mean, I wonder if he could imagine what that might be like.
I would have given anything to have been at that dinner party for all that, you know.
I mean, yeah, the atmosphere. I mean, it sounds like it would have been a prank.
Maybe.
I mean, it's hard to know because with Sellers being the way he was, it could have been completely sincere and him just not comprehending what was wrong with what he was doing.
Yeah, I wonder who, if it was the mid-60s, he was with Brit. So I wonder where she was while all this was going on. So, final thoughts, conclusions on Postman's Knock.
It's not awful. It's fine on its own terms. It's just, there's so much potential there. And I feel like I've said this several times. There's so much potential to do something with a performer like Spike, someone with a very specific style, someone with a very original, unusual sense of humour. And you could have done a lot with the idea of a figure like that in the Postal Service. I'm sure they've done post-based episodes of The Goon Show.
They have, yes.
And it's just thrown away on something light and disposable. They could have made the effort to create a new comedy star in the movies, and instead they just tried to force him into a pre-existing shape, and it didn't work. And it just seems such a waste.
Yeah. Well, I often think, because I watch a lot of old movies, as I'm sure you do, I know you do, and low-budget British films of around this period, late 50s into the 60s, the last act would often culminate in either a car chase or just a chase of some description, as we get in this, which is just lazy, I think. It's a lazy way of rounding out a film.
If you can do something original with it, if you can find an original angle, or if you're doing it in a comedy, then you can work out some original gags to do, then that's fine, I think. I mean, cliches work for a reason. And I think figuring out how to make them work in a fresh, unusual way is often the secret to good writing and good joke writing.
Mm-hmm. But when it's crowbarred in.
But when it feels like that situation arises naturally out of the story. So it doesn't feel forced in and of itself. But you're right in that it just feels like this is just the same that we see before. It's just rote formula material.
Mm. And yeah, so it was, with the exception of The Great McGonagall, it was the last starring vehicle on celluloid, at least for Spike. But look, I mean, no one can say he didn't have a fantastic career, and such an influential man, and such a great body of work.
Well, absolutely. I mean, not everyone who's tremendously creative is going to be equally successful in every arena. I mean, how many jokes have there been about David Bowie's film career?
Mm-hmm. I quite like Absolute Beginners.
Well, I quite like Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. But, I mean, he also did the Linguini incident and turned down the villain role in A View to a Kill because he said he didn't want to spend 6 months watching his stunt double falling off cliffs.
Oh, he's great. He's great in Yellowbeard.
I haven't seen it.
You've never seen Yellowbeard?
No, I haven't.
He's got a small cameo as a shark.
Oh, yes. I remember reading about that. So, yeah, that ties it all together, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was quite proud of this. I posted a picture of a screenshot of Bowie with his, as the shark from Yellowbeard, and I captioned it, "The Thin White Duke." Thought that was quite
excellent.
Anyway, let's move on from that. Jeremy, listen, thank you so much for joining me today. And if people want to check out Cinema Limbo, we've already obviously touched on it, but where is it available?
It's available from your usual podcatchers, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Acast. Mm-hmm. We have a video feed as well, where I review every film that I see for the first time, whether it's a new release or something from the archive. And that's updated maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And I'm on Twitter at @cinema_limbo.
Very good, very good. And you're not weekly or even monthly, are you? It's not as regular.
No, I mentioned earlier that I'd moved out of London. It's made it a bit harder to organise recordings because I can't be in the room. So the release rate's gone down to once every 4 weeks at the moment, but I'm hopeful that I might be able to increase that back to fortnightly in the near future.
Hopefully I can come back and do another one at some point.
Well, after the mess you made of the furniture last time, I make no guarantees.
All right, Jeremy. Well, thanks again, mate, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks to you very much. Bye.
He rides down the street, he pedals on the floor. Everybody's eager to hear the postman snore.
Before the lark, or the crowing of the cock, when the morning dawning, you'll hear that postman stop.
He's out with the dawn, he works around.